Well, to give a few thoughts about Deborah's song here in Judges 5. Well, it is a song of victory, but I think you do see a fair bit of resentment and even bitterness that she had done this work pretty much alone with very little support, and that so many other Israelites had not risen up to the challenge of obeying God's word and supporting her. So let's just go through it then. Verse 5, the mountains melted at the presence of Yahweh, even this Sinai, the AV says, at the presence of Yahweh. This Sinai, she was nowhere near Sinai, but I think as she looked up at the mountains, she felt this is a repeat of what happened there at Sinai, that God's manifestation, that great theophany that happened there has happened to me. And this is the power of biblical history, that even if history generally, in a secular sense, is bunk or of passing cultural fascination, interest, and little more, even if that is the case, as how most people, I suppose, look at history, biblical history is different in that the incidents recorded are recorded because, in essence, they repeat in our lives. Verse 8, they chose new gods. This is Israel. Therefore, war came to their gates. In Jeremiah 2, God laments this, how most people, most nations, had their gods, and they were very loyal to their gods, and they did not change their gods. They didn't go after other gods. Whereas Israel are presented as a sexually addicted woman who is always looking for other lovers, having relationships with multiple gods, and God sees this as utterly perverse, that the Gentiles, the tribes around Israel, were absolutely loyal to their gods, and they did not mix and match as they wanted. And this was the tragedy when the Jerusalem temple finally fell to the Babylonians, and it was full of all manner of different gods. This is one reason the Babylonians got mad with the Jews at that time, that they had made contracts with these people, and the deal was, you worship our gods, and these guys, the Jews, are worshipping all kind of gods. They've made deals with the Egyptians and all sorts of people. And also, of course, continued a semblance of worshipping Yahweh. So this is a tragedy of those who can't settle down with God, who are always wanting to push off here, push off there, try this philosophy, try that religion, try this particular path in life or that. It's like someone married to a really good man or really good woman, but they're always flirting around with somebody else, always wanting some other way, never satisfied. This is not the way. Of course, it requires an element of self-control, but it also requires us, I think, to see the hugeness, the vastness of God's special love for me. And in that case, you will not go off to other gods. You will not choose new gods. Well, I began by saying that this song of Deborah is not without its resentment and bitterness that others in Israel hadn't come to support her. And yet those who did were perhaps not the most well qualified. And she basically says, look, this was a man's job, but Barak didn't want to do it, so it fell to me to be a mother in Israel. And the victory was, of course, given into the hand of a woman, Jael, when she killed Sisera. So verse 14, she praises, those who handle the writer's quill came out of Zebulun. The idea is that instead of drawing their quills from their pouches to write, they drew swords. So the victorious warriors were writers and civil servants, not people who were maybe military people. It's rather like the time of the rebuilding of Jerusalem in Nehemiah 3. There were goldsmiths and chemists doing the manual work of building the wall of Jerusalem, bruising their sensitive fingers against lumps of rock. You think of how Paul was sent to the Gentiles and Peter was sent to the Jews. Well, we would have thought that Peter would have been far better from sort of half-Gentile Galilee, going there, talking to the Gentiles. When he does preach to the Jews, he's mocked as unlearned and ignorant, agrammatos, without grammar. And we would have thought that Paul, as the razor-sharp intellectual rabbi, would have been far better sent to confound the Jews. But no, God did it another way. Peter was sent to the Jews and Paul to the Gentiles. So, yeah, Judas was put in charge of the money amongst the 12, whereas Matthew had been a tax collector, and surely he'd have been a better accountant and a more honest one. Naaman wanted to do some great act, didn't he? But he was asked to just dip himself in the Jordan, which at that time was probably no more than a stream, a muddy stream. So this is how God works. It is our inadequacy, which is our adequacy, and which is finally our qualification to be used by him. Verse 15, by the watercourses of Reuben there were great divisions of heart. She's mocking how the men of Reuben didn't come to help. They were there pondering in their hearts, should we or shouldn't we, when God has unambiguously called them to come and help her in the fight. So often you hear the phrase, oh, God, I'm really struggling in my life over this, or, oh, it's so hard to decide, isn't it? And you think, well, in ultimate terms, it isn't, really. There may be great divisions of heart. But actually, I think as you mature, you see that there's only one way. Verse 16, why did you sit among the sheepfolds, listening to the bleating of the flocks? And she repeats it, at the watercourses of Reuben there was much searching of heart. She's mocking this searching of heart, just listening to the flocks bleating. And she says, why was this? Well, simple answer is that they were not totally committed to God's word. They did not have the view that God has spoken, therefore we must respond. Good News Bible helps us out here a bit. Yes, the tribe of Reuben was divided. They couldn't decide to come. I think the idea is that Reuben said, well, if there is unanimity, if we all agree, then we shall all go. But they were divided. The committee was divided. The house was divided. So none of us will come. And you see there the myth of unity. It's a mantra that's very often used that, we need to all be decided together. And otherwise, you see, we might risk division. And this is something you very often encounter in church life and generally in political life. And no, you see, God's word is his word, and it ultimately comes to each person as an individual. And to say, well, yeah, I actually was all in favour of it, but we couldn't because the majority decided otherwise. Well, you need to think about God's command not to follow a multitude to do wickedly. Because that's the myth of democracy, that we do what the majority wants, even though it's very often not a 51% majority. But so what? What's the difference between that and the mob rules? What's the difference between that and following a multitude to do evil? The response must be personal. Verse 23, curse Miroz, said the angel of Yahweh, curse bitterly its inhabitants. Because they didn't come to help Yahweh against the mighty. Well, isn't that a hymn that says God requires not help from man? And sure, in the ultimate sense, of course, God is sovereign. But in another sense, God is in need of man. Because he does not manipulate. He does not force human free will. He does not force hands. He works with human free will, and although he is omnipotent and finally requires not help from man, he has delegated so much to us because he respects human free will. So she ends up, of course, glorifying in verse 26 how it was Jael who put her right hand to the workman's hammer. It was a woman who was, in fact, it seems, actually living in an encampment that was pro-Sisera, and her husband was a leader of it, and yet it was her who won the victory. The Septuagint says she stretched forth her left hand to the nail. So it's as if she used her left hand. Why stress this? You remember Ehud, who was left-handed and yet used by God? There's quite a theme of left-handed people being used. Judges 3, you've got one there, and we notice how God used left-handed slingers to give David victory. 1 Chronicles 12, again in Judges 20, left-handed people are used. Well, in primitive societies, left-handed people were thought to be weird, to be odd, have something the matter with them. Even in the 20th century, no left-handed person could work for the government in Albania. And it's been the case in a lot of primitive societies that left-handed people are seen as odd and possibly demon-possessed or dangerous or certainly weird and not to be used, as I say, even in the 20th century in Albania. No civil servant could be left-handed. And yet, it was exactly the left-handed people and through the usage of the left hand that God worked his great victories. And so again, you see this whole message to us that do not think that you are not qualified. God will use you. He really will. And it is your sense that, oh, I'm not qualified to do this, which means that you are qualified. This is the great paradox.